Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our Wednesday lunch at Lowy for this week. This week and next week, we concentrate on the issue of development aid. Development aid certainly seems at a tipping point currently. We've just seen a review of the world's progress towards the Millennium Development Goals, and the progress hasn't been that spectacular. In fact, in most parts of the world, in most countries of the world, the pledges to meet those Millennium Development Goals will fall short of the mark. We also have seen the commitment, the bipartisan commitment of the Australian government and opposition to raise Australia's foreign aid budget to 0.5 of GNI by 2015-2016. That will see, on some projections, our foreign aid budget double to some $8 billion by that particular time. We've also seen in recent years development of some fairly high-profile critiques of the entire process of development aid. People such as William Easterly and Dambisa Moyo have argued that aid not only doesn't help development in the developing world, it actually makes things worse. So this is a period of unprecedented interest, concern and attention to development aid. And of course, the Australian government has just conducted a review into Australia's development assistance program. So it gives us great pleasure to welcome today one of Australia's newest parliamentarians, one of Australia's highest profile parliamentarians, Dr. Andrew Leigh, who is the federal member for Fraser in the ACT. Dr. Leigh was elected to the seat of Fraser in the 2010 federal election. He replaced the retiring member, Bob McMullen, who was most recently the parliamentary secretary for international development assistance. Prior to entering politics, Dr. Leigh was a professor of economics at the Australian National University. He holds a PhD in policy studies from Harvard and has previously worked as a lawyer and policy advisor. He has written extensively on a range of subjects from social capital to economic policy, and he is a fortnightly contributor to the Australian Financial Review. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Andrew Leigh.
Thanks very much, Michael. And I'd like to begin, of course, by acknowledging that we're meeting today on the traditional lands of the Indigenous peoples. It's a great pleasure to be here at the Lowy Institute, one of Australia's great policy institutions. Australian policymaking needs fresh ideas. That's how it's replenished year after year. And some of those ideas will come from within the public service, and some will come from within academia, and others will come from journalists and public policy commentators. But bringing together those strands is a unique role. And Lowy, since its inception, and I'm happy to say that I was even involved a little in the stages of thinking about what Lowy would look like, has been an extraordinary institution. And Michael, following in the footsteps of Alan Gingell, has done a great deal to contribute to a better policy debate in Australia, both through papers which are readable and important, and also through conversations such as these. I'd like to begin by telling a story. Dai Manju lived in a small village in central China. Because her parents were ill and couldn't afford the cost of sending her to school, she dropped out of school. When journalist Nicholas Kristof visited in 1990, she was just hanging around the school, hoping to pick up bits of knowledge. After publishing a front-page article about Dai in the New York Times, Kristof was chuffed to receive a donation of $10,000 from a reader. He promptly sent the $10,000 on to the school in China, which then spent it on improving facilities and provided Dai with a scholarship to stay in education for as long as she continued to pass her exams. After a good share of the money had been spent, Kristof phoned the donor to thank him for the generous gift. He said there was a long pause, and the man said, "But I didn't send $10,000, I sent $100. It turned out that the bank teller making the transfer had had a slip of the fingers and had multiplied the donation 100-fold. Nick Christoff called up the bank, which graciously agreed to provide the remainder of the donation, of the difference as a donation. After graduating as an accountant, Di now runs her own business, employing many others, and is able to send money back to improve the lives of her parents, because many of the other girls in her class also received bank error in your favour scholarships. The village now has a road. Spent wisely, foreign aid can transform lives for the better. This year alone, Australia's foreign aid program will build 2,000 schools in Indonesia, fund a women's crisis centre in Fiji, prevent 8,000 cases of blindness in Asia, and provide clean water to 1 million people in Africa. World Vision CEO Tim Costello claims that Australia's foreign aid budget this year alone will save 200,000 lives. Yet too often aid debates become removed from the people they're intended to help. When aid advocates ask the public for donations, they typically ask for help to solve an immediate and a practical problem: feeding a child, building a well, providing school books. To the best of my knowledge, and please correct me if you think I'm wrong about this, no aid campaigner ever knocked on a suburban door on a Sunday morning and, when it was opened, said to the resident, "We'd like you to consider increasing your aid contribution to 0.5% of your income in 2015-2016, with the ultimate ambition of going to 0.7% of your household income in the future." Don't get me wrong, the quantum of aid is important, and I recognise that Australia's aid contribution as a share of national income at the moment still places us in the bottom third of donor countries. Scaling up our aid to half a cent in the dollar will put us at the developed country average. This is eminently sensible for Australia, given that 18 of our 20 nearest neighbours are developing nations, and we sell $90 billion worth of goods to developing countries every year. In fact, few developed nations have as much self-interest in running a good aid program as Australia. We should never forget that the purpose of foreign aid is to alleviate disadvantage. More aid creates the potential for reducing poverty, but will not happen automatically. Although the input wallahs would occasionally have us believe otherwise, the most interesting debates in foreign aid are not about the quantum of assistance. So today I want to suggest a few ideas about how to increase the effectiveness of Australia's aid program. This is particularly important in the context of the scaling up of our aid program. Over the next 4 years, Australia's aid budget will almost double in nominal terms. And this represents a unique opportunity, perhaps in our lifetimes, to ensure that Australia's aid is spent in a way that does as much good as possible. For an economist like me, that means identifying Australia's comparative advantages in foreign aid and rigorously evaluating our aid programs. So let me deal with each of those in turn. The principle of comparative advantage is that individuals and nations should specialise in the things we do best. If I'm a good cook but a lousy storyteller, and my wife has the reverse trays, it might make sense for me to cook dinner and her to put the kids to bed. Internationally, the principle of comparative advantage suggests that countries' economies should stick to their knitting rather than trying to produce everything they wish to consume. Comparative advantage applies to altruism too. Where there's need in the world, it makes sense for Australia to focus on the foreign aid strategies that we are comparatively best at. Since our aid will always remain a small share of global development assistance, it will do most good if it's focused. In part, our aid program will be defined by our place in the world. Ours is the largest economy in a neighbourhood that, as I've said, is dominated by developing countries. We'll have to remain engaged with our neighbours on a wide range of development issues. Unlike nations in Northern Europe, we don't have the luxury of being highly selective in the countries we choose to engage with. Basic services and governance in countries like Indonesia, East Timor, and Papua New Guinea rightly remain a core focus of Australia's aid program. But beyond basic service delivery, There's still enormous needs in the developing world and limited resources to meet those needs. So our aid program needs to prioritise where it can be most effective. As I see it, Australia has three comparative advantages in foreign aid. Our first comparative advantage is that we're unusually well endowed in natural resources. This is particularly important in light of the resource curse, the fact that developing nations who have more natural resources are also more likely to be poverty-stricken dictatorships. The resource curse arises because mineral endowments tempt despots into fighting their way into power and filching the wealth. It's difficult, if you're an autocrat, to steal people's incomes that come from farming or industry or services. But if incomes come from diamonds, then it looks great to be a dictator. And the curse can be seen today in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where conflict over the country's minerals has grown particularly fierce since the mid-1990s, with bands of thugs murdering 5 million people, raping 500,000 women, and impoverishing a nation. The vast majority of Congo's population would be better off if their country had no natural resources whatsoever. Oxford economist Paul Collier points out that if we can help developing nations to make better use of their natural resources, the resulting fiscal flows could help societies to transform themselves for the better. In developed nations like ours, oil and mineral assets generally benefit the entire population, but in most low-income countries, the opposite is true. If developing countries could benefit from their minerals, the payoff could dwarf anything that aid might hope to deliver. Collier points out that in rich nations, where geologists have pretty carefully surveyed the land, the typical square kilometre has subsoil assets worth $114,000. Well, I guess that's about $120,000. In all probability, the same is true for the developing world. And on these figures, Africa's natural resources would be worth $3.5 trillion, more than 70 times the amount of foreign aid it receives every year. And indeed, $3.5 trillion is probably an underestimate. In recent years, the petroleum frontier has shifted south from the Middle East to West Africa. Central Africa is rich in everything from gold to coltan, which is used in all of your mobile phones. And Southern Africa, of course, has precious stones. To help developing nations make better use of their natural resources, a group of ex-politicians and entrepreneurs working with academics like Collier have proposed a natural resource charter, which they hope will be adopted by governments, businesses and NGOs. The charter aims to go beyond the ideological slanging match that's characterised natural resource use in developing nations and offer practical ways in which governments can ensure that people get a better deal. The charter proposes that financial flows be fully transparent. Mining generates relatively few jobs, so what happens to the royalties is critical. Through the Publish What You Pay campaign and the Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative, mining companies, including the estimated 230 Australian mining companies currently operating in Africa, are encouraged to release information about the payments they make to governments. This makes it harder for corrupt officials and politicians to siphon it off into private bank accounts and enables citizens to pressure governments into spending the money on much-needed infrastructure, such as hospitals, schools, roads. The charter also argues that extraction rights should be sold by auction. Once a handful of bidders participate in an auction, it becomes difficult for them to collude, and the final price is likely to reflect what the rights are actually worth. Collier likes to use the example of Britain, which was on the verge of negotiating a £2 billion deal to sell mobile phone spectrum, when some economists persuaded the UK Treasury to try an auction instead. The resulting auction in the UK raised £22.5 billion. Collier's argument to developing country governments is simple. If the UK Treasury can get it wrong by a factor of 10, what makes you think you'll do better in negotiating rather than auctioning? The charter also suggests that developing country governments should maximise the amount of information about a country's subsoil assets. If governments, or indeed aid donors, conduct geological surveys and make them publicly available, then the people of that nation are more likely to get a fair deal for their natural resources. Another way to increase information is to require that auction winners begin prospecting within a fixed period of time. If one miner strikes it lucky, this will raise the sale price when nearby parcels are auctioned off. Further, the charter requires that local people should be made better off by mining. Before lending to extraction projects, the World Bank requires free, prior and informed consent, a principle the charter argues should also extend to the way that national governments manage local consultations. Provocatively, it also suggests that where mining companies promise to conduct environmental reclamation, they might be kept to their word via the use of an escrow account. Australia's second comparative advantage in foreign aid is in dryland farming. As a nation raised on poems about dry riverbeds, failed crops and dying cattle, it's easy to forget that agriculture in other parts of the world tends to be a rather more stable affair than it is in Australia. But the experience has given Australian farmers more knowledge about good water management, selection of hardy crops and animals, and the proper management of seed stocks. Some of this knowledge is currently being conveyed through the Australian Centre on International Agricultural Research, our involvement in the World Food Programme, and the G20 Committee for World Food Security. Wherever we can, we should be exporting our expertise in Australian dryland farming. Improving agricultural productivity is critical to boosting living standards. As you probably know, the 1960s and 1970s saw a green revolution where the combination of hybrid seeds, chemical fertilisers, pesticides and herbicides massively raised agricultural output. By one estimate, the green revolution saved 1 billion people from starvation. Yet today, African cereal yields are 66% below the global average, and Africa as a continent is a net food importer. Africa has one tractor per 868 hectares, compared to one tractor per 56 hectares globally. Farming also has a critical gender dimension, since 70% of developing country farmers are women. One success story has been Malawi, which has recently doubled agricultural output through the combination of modern seeds and fertilisers. We should consider whether elements of this model can be extended to other African countries, perhaps through innovative farming financing models. Another implication of dryland farming is price volatility. Some climate models predict increased rainfall volatility in Africa's Sahel, a region containing Chad and Niger, where average incomes are less than a dollar a day. Closer to home, Pacific Island nations are likely to lose freshwater supplies and fertile land due to seawater inundations. Economist Ted Miguel suggests that aid agencies should work with developing country governments to provide drought insurance to rural households. Australia's drought assistance schemes do have their critics, but given our expertise in designing such schemes for our own farmers, this is a natural area for our aid workers to focus on. Australia also has a role to play on the international agricultural stage. As a major exporter of agricultural products, we set up the Cairns Group of Agricultural Free Trading Nations in 1986. Today, Australia has a strong interest in arguing against policies that harm developing country farmers just as they harm Australian farmers. If the United States were to abolish its ethanol subsidies and the European Union were to adopt a more science-based approach to genetically modified foodstuffs, agriculture in developing countries would be significantly more viable. Our third comparative advantage is operating in post-conflict environments. Where the two advantages that I've talked about were things we chose, this is one that circumstances thrust upon us. From our experience in East Timor and the Solomon Islands, Australia has acquired valuable experience in post-conflict environments. Of the top five recipients of Australian foreign aid, four of them are countries that are often described as fragile states. Getting intervention right in post-conflict environments involves some delicate balancing acts. One of my favourite stories is told by former economist journalist Robert Guest. He writes, "Somalia has no government, unless you count a transitional one that controls a few streets in the capital, Mogadishu, and a short stretch of coastline. The rest of the country is divided into warring fiefdoms. Warlords extract protection money from anyone who has money to extract. Clans, sub-clans and sub-sub-clans pursue bloody vendettas against each other, often fighting over grudges that predate the colonial period. Few children learn to read, but practically all self-respecting young men carry submachine guns. I was at one of those country's countless roadblocks, on a sandy road outside Baidoa, a southern town of shell-blasted stone walls and sandy streets. The local warlord's men were waving their Kalashnikovs at approaching trucks, forcing them to stop. Many of the trucks carried passengers perched atop the cargoes of logs or oil drums. The men with guns then ordered all the children under five to dismount and herded them into the shade of a nearby tree. There, they handed them over to strangers with clipboards who squeezed open their mouths and fed each one a single drop of polio vaccine. Aid to fragile states requires considerable nous. In his Lowy Institute paper on the Australia-led regional assistance mission to the Solomon Islands, Michael Fullilove argued that Ramsay succeeded in stabilising the Solomons because it was preventative, permissive, regional in nature, nationally led, supported by the United Nations, non-sovereign, police-led and light touch. While Fullilove is cautious about suggesting that any post-conflict operation should be a blueprint for future missions, there are clearly experiences out of our work in East Timor and the Solomon Islands that can be used for other contexts. Part of this is about recognising that the rise of terrorism is likely to increasingly blur the lines between military, policing and aid operations. Increasingly, in places like Afghanistan, Australia and our allies are performing roles that meld all of these, what David Kilcullen famously described as armed social work. This demands better planning, training and integration across government agencies than ever before. For example, literacy rates in Uruzgan province, where Australia works, are 8% for men and 1% for women. Remarkable improvements have occurred in Afghanistan, but many basic measures of well-being are still appallingly low. Improving basic education is one of our most powerful tools for economic development, better governance, and stopping extremism. But how do we know in aid what's actually working? If we move past the simplistic focus on inputs only, it'll require greater certainty about how Australia's aid programs impact on the developing world. In some areas, we have this already. For example, we know that Australian aid has immunised 900,000 children in Papua New Guinea against measles, supported thousands of students to study in Australia, including the current PNG Secretary for Education, and rehabilitated thousands of kilometres in road in places like Laos and Samoa. But in other cases, the right aid strategy is less clear. Take the case of bed nets. It's undisputed that malaria causes around 1 million deaths in Africa, most of them children. An insecticide-treated bed net costs around $10, lasts around 5 years, and halves the chance of getting malaria. Yet less than one quarter of children at risk in Africa sleep under a bed net. But major figures in the aid world have disagreed over the right policy response. Jeffrey Sachs and others have suggested that people should be given free bed nets. William Easterly and Dembisa Moyo, two people that Michael mentioned in his introduction, argue that people don't value handouts, and if you give people free bed nets, they're more likely to be used as wedding veils or fishnets. So, who do we believe, Sachs or Easterly and Damboyo? To answer the question, researchers from the University of California, Los Angeles, carried out a randomised trial in which villagers in Uganda and Madagascar were randomly selected to receive bed nets that were either free or modestly subsidised. Their results provide a clear and unequivocal answer. Free bed nets have substantially higher take-up rates than nets that are merely subsidised, and free bed nets are equally likely to be used. One of the most famous randomised trials in development economics is the Progressor experiment, which tested whether it was possible to boost educational attendance through conditional cash transfers. In other words, providing money to households on the condition that their children attend school. The program was the brainchild of Santiago Levy, an economics professor who was then Mexican finance minister. To avoid the program being scrapped by the next government, as apparently happens quite a lot in Mexico, Levy wanted to produce evidence that was so irrefutable that the next government would just have to continue it. And he did just that. By randomising the implementation of Progressor across villages, the study showed that conditional cash transfers were an extremely effective way of raising education levels. When the Mexican government changed, the new government changed the name, so Progressor is now called Oportunidades, but the policy has remained. Conditional cash transfers now exist in over 30 developing nations. Thanks to centres such as the Abdul Latif Jamil Poverty Action Lab at MIT and Innovations for Poverty Action at Yale University, we now have hundreds of rigorous results from randomised policy trials in developing nations. Just as with new pharmaceuticals, randomised trials provide extremely strong evidence for or against particular policies. Let me give you some of my favourite examples. A randomised trial of teacher merit pay in the Indian state of Andhra Pradesh has shown that it raised student performance on both high-stakes tests and on low-stakes tests, and found little evidence that teachers responded to merit pay by engaging in cheating. A randomised trial in Malawi provided financial incentives for HIV testing, and it showed that people who discovered they were HIV positive were more likely to then engage in safe sex. A randomised trial in Madagascar found that simply telling parents the average income gain from their child getting one more year of schooling reduced dropout rates. In Kenya, HIV infection rates are substantially higher among teenage girls, the 15 to 19-year-old cohort, than they are among teenage boys of the same age. The fact is generally attributed to the prevalence of sugar daddies. A randomised trial showed that a program that promoted abstinence among young women did nothing for HIV infection rates. But a program that told young girls the basic fact that older men are more likely to be HIV positive substantially reduced infection rates and virtually halved teenage pregnancies. And a randomised trial of microfinance in India found that it increased the fraction of families that started a small business by about 2 percentage points, but didn't seem to empower women and didn't seem to shift expenditures on education or on health. Earlier this year, I moved a private members' motion in the House of Representatives calling on all government agencies to subject more of their programs to rigorous randomised trials. Although randomised trials aren't a perfect evaluation tool, my view is that for most purposes, they're superior to other impact evaluation approaches, such as matching or before-after comparisons. Yet, to the best of my knowledge, AusAid presently does no randomised trials whatsoever. Looking at the challenge of development, it's easy to become pessimistic. 1.4 billion people live in poverty, and two-thirds of those are in our region. Every day, 22,000 children under the age of 5 die from preventable or treatable conditions. Millions are living in makeshift camps, displaced from their home by conflict or economic hardship. Teenage gangs commit acts more appalling than any Hollywood horror movie producer would dream up. And yet there's reason for optimism too. Technologies like micronutrient supplements and mobile phones can transform opportunities for the poorest. Organisations like the Global Fund, the Gates Foundation and the Gavi Alliance, and here I'm only picking one letter of the alphabet, combine sharp-edged analysis with serious funding and are delivering measurable results. For Australia, some of the challenges of the developing world are challenges we've faced in the past. Since the Eureka Stockade, our nation has been devoting attention to ensuring that mineral wealth benefits us all. Making a living from agriculture in the world's driest inhabited continent was a challenge for the Indigenous people, as it was for European settlers. And in our social policies, there's an increasing recognition that improving the quality of evaluations will help us make the best use of scarce taxpayer dollars. Spent wisely, Australian aid can literally help to change the world. Thanks very much.
Absolutely.
Andrew, thank you.
thank you very much. We now have about half an hour for audience questions and answers. I might get the ball rolling. One issue that you didn't mention in your speech was the issue of corruption. A lot of the countries we give aid to are countries that are fairly low down on the corruption index, and yet by scaling up our aid spending, there's an increased requirement that we justify that our aid dollar is being spent effectively. Do you have any ideas about what to do about avoiding corrupt outcomes in aid spending?
Michael, it's a great question and one that's quite close to my heart. The first thing to say is that the corruption levels are low. FACSIA has a higher rate of fraud than AusAid. The current AusAid corruption rate is something in the order of 0.1% of its budget. And that's a recognition of the fact that WealthAustralia has been pretty careful in managing fraud in our aid program. But it's also that a non-zero rate of fraud is a recognition that when you operate in the world's poorest countries, then you're operating in places where there are challenges with governance. When you try and construct things, you expose yourself to a sector which is particularly prone to corruption. If you ran an aid program that simply bought industrial goods, for example, say we wanted to supply tractors to Papua New Guinea, then we could be fairly sure that we would buy them at the quoted price because we could purchase them and send them off to Papua New Guinea. But in fact, often what we'd want to do is we want to construct things. And constructing things is always uncertain. So if you engage somebody to build a school, there's some uncertainty about the cost of that eventual project. And so that's why systematically throughout the world, the construction sector has more fraud, overspends, misallocation of funds than other sectors. But building schools is a really good thing to do. We should continue to build schools, and if we ran an aid program that simply paid white guys to give advice or bought things off the shelf and sent them to developing countries, we'd have less impact on poverty. So the aim of reducing fraud is an important one, but that's not why we run an aid policy. I use the analogy of a football team. Football teams never like their players to get injured, but coaches equally see the main point as being winning the game, not getting the injury rate to zero. Yeah.
So, just wait for the microphone.
Michael Ahrens, your first point about the use of our skills in relation to natural resources and all the companies going to Africa ties in with your last response, because they are operating very vulnerably in these countries prone to corruption. You mentioned EITI. There seems to be resistance in Canberra for Australia to sign onto that program. I mean, it's all very well to advocate it for East Timor successfully, but why doesn't Australia, with the huge number of mining companies here, implement EITI here?
So, Michael, I haven't followed the details of that discussion, but my understanding is that it is essentially a symbolic question. I don't think there are many people, at least you don't see them in the mainstream debate, arguing that mining royalties in Australia are being siphoned off by corrupt officials. The question is simply whether we could show developing countries how the model might operate. And I know there's a discussion going on about that, but it's important to recognise it's essentially a symbolic point rather than a sort of direct practical one. Allegations of corruption aren't major. But we do need to work in well with our mining companies. I mean, it's one of the things that your question raised, which I guess I neglected to bring out enough, that so many of these the world's big miners are Australian firms, and we need to engage creatively with those firms and encourage them to be publishing what they pay to developing countries around the world, because then that allows civil society to do its job of saying, well, the mining company said it gave you $100 million last quarter. We don't see any new schools, roads, or hospitals. So show us your Swiss bank account. And that's a really important process to be engaged in. And it moves the NGOs out of this space of saying that mining is bad. I don't think that's a particularly productive space for NGOs to be in. I think mining in the developing world is a reality, and the question is making sure that the peoples of the developing world get the benefits from it, not simply saying stop all the mines.
Yeah. Lady up the back.
Hi, Robin Norton from the George Institute for Global Health. I was overwhelmed by your comments about evaluation. I think many of us have felt over the years that AusAid has seen evaluation or research as a dirty word. So it's very impressive that you're saying that whatever we do, we must evaluate. As you well know, I'm sure that proper evaluation requires money, not just a small amount of money attached to a program implementation. How do you propose to go about changing the culture within AusAid so that it would value evaluation as you are proposing and actually put money behind that concept of evaluation so that we do true evaluations and randomised controlled trials?
Yeah, look, it's a really important point, Robin. I don't think that the cost of randomised trials is massive. Certainly, there's a number of US programs by which the federal government provides money to the states, insist on randomised evaluations and sets aside a couple of percent of the budget for that. My sense is that in the typical AusAid project, the process evaluation, by which I mean the verbiage that's produced to describe the way in which the program operates is costing a couple of percentage points as it is. The question is whether we could move a little away from the descriptive results and more towards what an economist would describe as impact evaluation. But it does tie into the fraud question before. What you're most concerned about is the kinds of tabloid stories which run from time to time about fraud, then what you want is a process evaluation. So we need to I think, have a really rigorous debate about what AID is doing and make sure that we're focusing on making a difference, having an impact, and that then naturally moves you from process evaluations to impact evaluations. I know AusAid is having this conversation internally. I know it also funds organisations which carry out randomised trials. In my former life at ANU, I was funded by AusAid to run a randomised trial as a research project. But it's that evaluation culture isn't yet integrated into the mainstream of AusAid's work.
Trevor.
Dr. Lee, first of all, congratulations.
There's a microphone on the way.
Thank you. Dr. Lee, firstly, Trevor Rowe, congratulations on entering politics. I think it's wonderful with someone with your youth and background going into politics.
Thank you.
It gives me hope about...
I hope to keep at least one of those characteristics.
Yeah. It gives me some hope policy debate will improve in this country. But Dr. Lee, I'm kind of curious about aid generally. Is it driven in the context of what is in Australia's geopolitical interests, or is it driven by sector vis-a-vis region or global interests in terms of the prioritising how we allocate aid as Australia?
Well, Trevor, there's that famous line from Harry Truman that he wanted a one-armed economist, because all of the economists are always saying on the one hand and on the other hand. I'm going to disappoint you by saying that our aid program is always going to be on the one hand, on the other hand. Paul Collier talks about the bottom billion, the billion people in the world currently living in countries that are experiencing stagnant growth rates. And almost all of those people live in Africa. If we were to focus solely on world poverty, you might think that we ought to focus on a purely Africa strategy. But I don't think that would be a reasonable approach to take to our neighbours. I don't think it would reflect our deep historical ties with a place like Papua New Guinea. So we're always going to need to walk and chew gum at the same time, to work closely with our region, but also to engage with Africa. I think engaging with Africa is absolutely the right thing to do, but we need to be extraordinarily strategic. We need to work out what it is in Africa that we can do better than other people, and that's what we should be doing. So that's, I guess, why I'm trying to inject this conversation about comparative advantage. If there's something that the Brits do better than us in Africa, we should consider whether we should shift out of that. And management of natural resources and dry land farming are things that I reckon we can really punch above our weight on and ought to be focusing on. But also with the scaling up of the aid budget, that's certainly a moment at which you say you can maintain that geographic focus but also pick up a focus on Africa as well. Does that answer your question there? You look a little uncertain.
I'm sort of looking more in the context where we find ourselves
geographically, both in terms of our geopolitical interests and our economic interests. In other words, does our aid endeavour to assist and promote Australian goods and services in an export context? And do we focus on the regions where we have influence, or are we sort of, I would have thought in an Africa context, our role would be so minimal as to be insignificant, I would have thought, other than a micro sense, whereas Asia-Pacific is much more relevant, particularly North Asia, to our future?
So I think it should be poverty first, and it just so happens that there are some other good things that flow from that. So just as a great sporting coach can win games and is only focused on winning games, it so happens when he manages to win more games, the stadium sells more soft drink and that people in the town feel happier. But he's not focused on that. He's focused on winning games. We should be focused on poverty alleviation, and it just happens that brings us more trade and a safer region. But I do dispute what you've said about Africa. I actually think we have a substantial role to play. Our Australian mining companies are serious players in Africa, and there's no reason why the policy focus on resource management can't be there as well.
Anne-Marie.
Thank you. Anne-Marie O'Keefe, Research Fellow, Lowry Institute, but also, so that you understand where I used to be, I was Deputy Director General at AusAid, so to put you into the context. Look, thank you very much for your presentation. I personally found it particularly interesting, and I think it's terrific that you, as a new member in Parliament, are taking such an interest in the aid program. I think that's absolutely essential to help the whole policy debate move forward. I guess I'm fascinated by your emphasis on the three comparative advantages, only from the perspective, I don't disagree with you, that Australia has those comparative advantages, but how do you actually inject them into the policy, into the program? At the moment, the sectoral priorities, what are they? Education stands out, health, governance, absolutely fundamental if you're going to get anything done, the environment, and of course if you're going to move forward you have to have economic growth. So how do you see your three comparative advantages either fitting into those sectoral priorities, or do you see them displacing those sectoral priorities? Thank you.
Thanks, Emery. I should say, actually, I mean, you're very kind about my comments on overseas aid. It turns out it just comes with my electorate. My predecessors were John Langmore and Bob McMullen. So it turns out that when you become member for Fraser, it's just required of you by the electorate that you develop an interest in foreign aid. But I think the scaling up of Australia's aid program does present a unique opportunity for us to do a little more on this, and to try and think about economic growth through a lens of efficient use of minerals. The Natural Resource Charter, I think, is a really important document, and I think part of the effectiveness of the Natural Resource Charter is there's a version for business, there's a version for the NGO sector, and there's a version for government. And so supporting that charter is important. I think the agricultural research work that's being done is also absolutely critical. And perhaps it's more, what I'm arguing is more a question of focus than anything else. So in anything that Australia does, I think we should always have in the back of our heads, Why are we doing this? Why can we do this better than other countries could? And so perhaps that notion of comparative advantage is more important than the any of the three examples that I've picked out.
Lady just here.
Hi, thank you. I'm Christina Landsberg, and I also must declare where I come from, and I'm from the Conflict and Fragility section in AusAid. And I just want to note that the World Development Report has come out recently, and it's got a focus on violence and conflict and how that affects fragile states particularly. Mm-hmm. But I think the point that it really makes very strongly is that in countries affected by violence and conflict, and I'll just say that AusAid funds 53% of its focus is on fragile and conflict-affected states. Change is generational. It will take up to 14, 20 years to actually be able to see that kind of change. So I suppose I take issue a bit, one, about the issue of evaluations. One, I think AusAid does a lot of them. But two, you know, measuring progress in institutional change, which is actually what is required over generations, is difficult. And I think, you know, I also just want to pick up on how on your three comparative advantages. One, I am not sure that AusAid has such a good advantage in terms of post-conflict states, but dry land farming and natural resources, the issue really is about institutional change in those countries to manage those things. And again, it comes back to generational change. So that's a comment, but also a question as to how you think AusAid should be responding then.
So I'm curious, why? Can you say a little bit more just before you give the microphone away as to why you don't think Australia necessarily has a comparative advantage in fragile states?
Well, I think I'm looking at it from the perspective rather that the label post-conflict is misleading in that the process is not linear from peace to conflict. And so to talk about us having a post-conflict advantage because of our experience in Timor and Solomons suggests that the situations are resolved there, and I don't think they are.
That's certainly true, yeah.
And I also think, you know, that the approach has to be a regional and global approach, and that we are external actors in these contexts, and it's absolutely critical that it's the partnership approach that we adopt. And I think there are a lot of people out there with, you know, more experience than us, including the UN and the World Bank.
Yeah. Well, let me take your statement about our comparative advantage in fragile states as a comment, and just then respond to one part of what you said, which was the role of evaluations in thinking about the various interventions we have. I agree that there are certain of our interventions, such as, say, our governance interventions, which aren't particularly amenable to good evaluation. But I think that doesn't rule out the notion of evaluation in these states. So one of my favourite studies is one by Chris Blattman, who looks at former child soldiers in Uganda. And he's trying to test the standard theory that child soldiers are destroyed shells of people, that the experience of walking around in the jungle with the Lord's Resistance Army, toting an AK-47 and doing unspeakably awful things leaves people unable to function. And Blattman actually finds the opposite. He finds that kids from the Lord's Resistance Army are more likely to participate in politics. They're more likely to get active in voluntary groups. In some sense, he says, you can think of the Lord's Resistance Army as being like a very, very violent experience of being part of the Young Labour or Young Liberals. So what you want to do with these, that dramatically changes what you want to do with ex-child soldiers. You want to seize their opportunities. You want to recognise that they might well make good entrepreneurs and good politicians. And you don't want to surround them with cotton wool, but you want to recognise that awful things have happened and you now want to make use of those skills. And the evaluations on microcredit and the evaluations on health, which you mentioned before, are other things which can shape how we operate in post-conflict environments. There's a lot to learn. I mean, the difference between military and policing was brought home to me when Hugh White pointed out to me that the average AFP recruit has a master's degree and the average foot soldier in the Australian Army didn't finish high school. Yet we somehow think of military and policing and we put them in the same breath. These are quite two quite different skill sets in Australia's army and police force at the moment, and rigorously evaluating how to operate this armed social work is important as well, I think.
Mate.
Thank you. Martin Litz from the Law Institute. Interesting, just to follow up on Trevor Rowe's question about meeting our other objectives through the aid program. I note just in passing that the Australian mining companies that are engaged in Africa have for a very long time called for greater diplomatic representation, more diverse diplomatic representation from Australia in African countries, precisely because it's also through those means that we can achieve, you know, more than just pulling stuff out of the ground and negotiating with governments about, you know, improving African countries' ability to work in collaboration with mining companies, which will benefit the mining companies, but also the improving the skill set and the economic development of those countries. So I think that's something that the Australian government needs to keep in mind, that in some parts of the world, diplomatic representation is still very important to meet both your aid objectives as well as your own economic objectives. But I'm interested in particular in your view about the role that the private sector plays in perhaps the multiplier effect of the benefits of aid. You mentioned, for example, the Gates Foundation and other big major private sector donors that are making major contributions to meeting global health objectives. But there is, in any of your studies, are you able to assess how important private donors have become in the global aid game and whether they make valuable partners with government, or whether you still think that it's basically still going to be government agencies and government development programs that will be the most effective in the dispersal of aid?
Well, certainly governments are the major player if you just look at pure dollars distributed. I haven't actually seen anyone look at whether the marginal payoff of a dollar of private sector assistance is larger or smaller than the marginal benefit of a dollar of public sector assistance. It would certainly be a fascinating question if we could answer it. But I think the partnerships at the moment are working pretty well. The bigger challenge, I think, in Africa is working out how we operate in the context of Chinese aid, which is increasingly dominant in Africa. Collier spends a lot of time talking about the role of Chinese government and state-owned enterprises in Africa. And one of the points he makes is that the Chinese business model is often, if you give us this mining right, we will build you this road. And that doesn't meet the tests of transparency, and it doesn't meet the tests of rights being auctioned off. But Collier argues that it does meet one test, which is that at least the people of that community are actually getting an asset in return for mining royalties. And so it may well be the case that increasingly, if we're operating in very corrupt environments, we might want to think about doing China-style infrastructure for mining deals, recognising that that might be a second-best world to operate in. But the role of China in Africa is enormously important, I think.
Gentlemen, just here.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm Alex Erskine. I'll claim an allegiance at the moment to that group of people who are white, who have been at one time white guys giving advice. I think you were fairly scathing there, and no doubt with some good reason. But I think you're a bit narrow on your selection of comparative advantages. I mean, yes, I'm sure we do have those three comparative advantages, but if you look around, you can find in niches some other comparative advantages, particularly compared to the rest of the world, which I think is what you're really trying to get at.
Yes.
You look at Australia getting through the global crisis, financial crisis. I know it's not positive alleviating poverty, but actually helping people avoid falling into poverty from financial crisis is something which I think Australia has a very strong comparative advantage in. And I'd like to see that on your list when it's expanded to more than three.
Yes. Well, certainly, Alex, you happen to be sitting behind my mother, who, with my father, dragged me off to Bandar Aceh for a couple of years when I was a little kid, and my father was working an AusAid project there. So I've certainly wouldn't want to argue we should never... never send white Australians overseas to work in our aid program. It even as a little kid, it shaped me enormously. But I think what you say about managing the insurance risk is enormously important. One of the I was in Norfolk Island a couple of weeks ago, which doesn't have a tax and transfer system. And I was trying to argue to them that one of the best things that you get out of the Australian tax and transfer system is a really good insurance policy. I have an insurance policy on my car and I have one on my house, but my best insurance policy is the fact that at the moment the Australian government extracts payments from me in every paycheck. If I was to lose my job, those payments would cease and they'd start coming back in the opposite direction. And a whole lot of people in developing countries simply don't have that form of insurance. The Ted Miguel example I was talking about with drought assistance goes on to make the point that revolutions in Africa are very frequently associated with droughts. And so it isn't just a matter of poverty, which is, of course, extremely important. It's also a matter of ensuring that countries don't slide into chaos as a result of simply not getting enough rain one year. And trying to manage that sort of insurance model is just enormously important. Individual shocks, like health shocks, as well as community-wide shocks like drought shocks.
Last question, gentleman at the back.
Hi, thank you so much. My name is Gerard McCarthy, and I'm representing Peace Dividend in South Sudan, and they do a lot of industry development in South Sudan. Huh. And one of the things that we see as one of the big assets of Australia is Australia's large southern Sudanese community. It's about 20,000 people. And a lot of these people were taken in under humanitarian and the migration, it's kind of skilled migrants, but a lot of them were humanitarian. I wanted you to just, touch a little bit on the migration and development nexus and particularly how we should be thinking about the broader objectives of our migration program and, thinking about the skills and remittances that are acquired by, refugees and migrants to Australia who subsequently either send money back. $360 billion last year was sent in remittances back to home countries, which is almost twice as much as international aid aggregately. So could you touch on the remittance point, but also how we should be thinking about, the services and skills training that we should be providing to refugees in Australia who, may go back to their country and, provide that strong asset of the building the institutions and the skills with some values that have been inculcated in Australia.
Yeah, John, wasn't it?
Gerard.
It's something that I see a lot in my electorate of Fraser. There's an organisation called Companion House, which works with victims of torture and violence. A lot of the people they deal with are young men who have one parent or no parents, and their job is to ensure that those young people are integrated into the Canberra community. And you just see this enormous reservoir of goodwill in the ACT, and I think a lot across Australia. So local sporting clubs will waive membership fees. Local schools will support teenage girls who've had a baby. Lots of the community groups are willing to sponsor refugees, and that's important that we continue to do, because as you say, those people will send remittances back, but also potentially might return and become community leaders. There's a woman by the name of Surawat who I met at a Canberra refugee support dinner a couple of weeks ago, who used to run an orphanage in Eritrea. If she stays in Canberra, we'll do extraordinary things. But if she was to go back to Eritrea, would be a great community sector leader there. So nurturing those ties are important. I have read some evidence that on remittances that the transaction fees for Australia are very high. And I haven't seen any concrete proposals, but I would love to see, you know, for just for example, a Lowy Institute analysis paper looking at transaction charges on remittances and some practical policy proposals for reducing them. Because frankly, if we can reduce the amount of money that is taken away from small remittances and increase the amount that gets back to those countries, then we make the world a better place.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much. I think we can all tell that there's a source of great ideas in the Australian Parliament now, certainly providing ideas for our aid program as well as the Lowy Institute's research agenda. So I do thank you. It's been a great pleasure to welcome you here. We hope we can welcome you back at some stage to speak again. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Andrew Lee.
Thank you.